Hello and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, episode 37. This is the number one comics podcast at AIPTComics.com. My name is David Brook, and this week I have very, very special guest, JJ Travers, the events coordinator with me as the co-host of the show. Welcome to the show, JJ.
Thanks for having me. Love the show. It's one of my go-tos. The second it pops up in Overcast, I listen. You and Forrest do a great job. But I am JJ with two J's, so sorry, Forrest. You're not the only one.
This is the comics podcast where we recap the news of last week. We talk about our two favorite books from last week as well. We give a heads up on what's coming out in the following week. We pick our number one book that we're looking forward to, and we also have fun segments. This week, we have very special guest David Pepos on to talk about his new book from Action Lab Studios called Going to the Chapel, which we've both read, and I think we both liked. So it's going to be a fun interview. That's later in the show. If you just hang on, you can get that to that interview where we'll talk about comic book writing, the book itself, et cetera, et cetera. But to start every show, we talk about the news, the very top news that everyone's talking about. And I have to say, the tippity top news this week is very much been talked about for a couple days. This is where the mayor, I cannot believe his first name, Marvelo Crivella of Rio de Janeiro, has put out a statement censoring and banning the 2010 Marvel Comics story Avengers: The Children's Crusade from a city book fair, which ran from August 30th to September 8th. We kind of only know about this because people started tagging us Thursday night and other comic book websites asking us to report on it because obviously this is censorship. He's censoring it. The reason he's giving is that there is, sexual acts in the comic?
Yeah, it's Wiccan and Hulkling kissing. That's it.
Right, and yet he's framing it as if there's like some kind of hardcore sex going on.
Yeah, and I remember, because we both have the site's Twitter account on our phones, like my phone was just blowing up, and I was like, what's going on? And I saw the initial message saying what was happening, but I don't speak Portuguese, and that's the video of this mayor like condemning this is in Portuguese, and the vast majority of the people that were commenting on this on Twitter were from Brazil, I assume, because it was in Portuguese. So I was like, I'd really love to be able to speak to this and understand what's going on, but I can't. So I was asking our staff and our Slack instance if anyone spoke Portuguese, and unfortunately nobody didn't, but it looks like Newsarama and Bleeding Cool were able to get some reporting done on it through tweets and through talking to some people. I guess I'm just kind of shocked that the mayor of one of the biggest cities in the world is worried about a comic book with two fictional characters kissing. Like, this is a concern for you?
Yeah, I guess he's an outspoken evangelical Christian, probably trying to just play to his base to look like some strong man, when really it's quite pathetic, isn't it?
Yeah, Brazil's not doing too hot right now, you know, burning the Amazon down, and they got a real jerk as their president. But we know what that's like, so.
I guess some good news is festival organizers refuse to comply. According to Newsarama's report on this, which actually came from a newspaper in Brazil.
It's Brazil's O Global newspaper.
So basically, certain vendors actually sold out of it. That's why they didn't even have it. Other vendors just refused and just kept selling it. So obviously, this is insane from someone of power like the mayor to be trying to push this on this book fair. Thankfully, nothing really came of it because obviously the vendors kept selling it. But he was definitely sending a message, an anti-gay message, I'd say.
Absolutely. I mean, what other message are you trying to send? I don't see how you can frame it as anything else. According to Newsarama's Google translation of a statement they released, it says the festival is to give a voice to all audiences without distinction, as a democracy should be, including next weekend. The festival will have three panels to discuss trans and LGBTQA plus literature. So that's pretty awesome. I mean, I think they handled it as best that they could have given the situation.
You know, I'm curious, as this news starts trickling out and getting picked up by other outlets, if the evangelical crowd in America might start picking up on it and going, yeah, comics should be banned. We'll see in the next couple of days, but hopefully not. Hopefully that language barrier is preventing them.
I don't know. I feel like at least in the US, the outrage machine on the internet just churns through things so quickly. So this might, it might be, you know, too far back for them to catch at this point.
That's true.
They're very upset about a Sharpie right now.
Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, the power of the pen, I suppose. In our next bit of news, I've got two, actually, Doomsday Clock newses for you. One, Gary Frank, the artist of Doomsday Clock, he came out on the day issue number 11 came out and said, guess what? The final 12th issue is coming out in November, which shocked everyone because every issue seems to be delayed 2 or 3 or even 4 months. And in this case, it's particularly shocking because DC released their November solicitations and there was no Doomsday Clock number 12 in there, which is kind of tells me something. It's probably not coming till December, if not January.
Is anyone surprised at this point?
No, it is surprising to me that Gary Frank would say that, though. But I guess maybe he doesn't have his thumb on the pulse and doesn't really know when it's coming out. Maybe that's just his hope.
I don't know. I just I can't help but think back to 2 years ago at New York Comic Con when I got to go to a wonderful event that I'm so to this day, it stands out as one of the coolest things I've got to do as a comic journalist. And it was for Doomsday Clock, and DC had this amazing event for the media. It was super cool. They basically transformed a gallery into Night Owl's hideout, and Geoff Johns was there to walk everyone through the first 30 panels of the book up on the wall, 3x5s with no text. And it was just, I can't remember being so excited for a book and a project. And it's 12 issues and we're 2 years later and it still isn't done.
Yeah, I mean, we're not quite at 2 years. I think November will be 2 years. But yeah, it's been a very long time to put out 12 single issues. It's really unfortunate too, because I feel like, you know, the pacing of a book kind of gets ruined. No one, not everyone's going to go back and reread every issue every time a new issue comes out. And they're going to forget when new issues come out.
That's exactly why I dropped it. I was initially so for this. I think I remember talking to you actually, and we had to kind of agree to switch off reviewing each issue because we were both so excited about it.
Yeah.
And I lost interest so quickly because I usually will go back and reread an issue or two if I'm reading something that I'm very invested in and I'm reviewing, but it's just ridiculous, the length in between each issue. I just can't stay invested in something like that.
Right, right. I if you go to aiptcomics.com, you can actually read my review of Doomsday Clock number 11. And I think there's a big problem with these delays. Killed it. But some good news is it actually will matter in the main universe, which they promised 2 years ago. I actually went to a party as well at San Diego Comic-Con that same year you went to your party on a boat, mine was. And Geoff Johns was there to answer questions to the press about Doomsday Clock. I mean, there was so much hype for it, which probably makes it even more of a disappointment on some level. Because, DC was all in with this series. And at the time, they were promising that it would matter to the overall DC universe. It's in canon. And Scott Snyder, in an interview with Newsarama, basically said the GSA that are in his book in Justice League number 30 are the same GSA that show up in Doomsday Clock.
Yeah, I saw that. So his are the younger version, right? No. Do I have it backwards?
I think Snyder's is the younger.
Yes, and then Frank's are present day.
Right.
Because Snyder has the whole, the universe is ending and all these different time periods and multiverses are, floating in and out of this story, which is cool, but I don't know. I just, it's so bittersweet for me because, Geoff Johns created my favorite comic book hero is Green Lantern, and he created Blackest Night, which in my opinion is one of the best stories of all time in comics. I know he can tell amazing stories. I loved his Aquaman run, but he's working on Stargirl, he's working on Teen Titans. I think he's also writing or co-writing the new Green Lantern film, so he's clearly got way too much going on. So it's just bittersweet because I can't help but wonder what this story would be if this was what he was working on and not all these other projects.
I still remember them revealing at San Diego Comic-Con 2018, so a year after Doomsday Clock number 1 came out, that he was going to be directing Stargirl and writing it. And the first thought in my mind was, how the hell is he going to finish Doomsday Clock?
Well, I think you have your answer.
I guess so.
I think he's also working on the new Wonder Woman film as well.
He could be a producer on it, yeah. He's tightly knit in that whole area.
Because he's got his new company that's, I think, a production company. I'm not positive exactly what their role is with Warner Brothers, but I know that they're heavily involved with the DC films.
Speaking of films, did you hear, have you ever heard of this character called Spawn?
Once or twice.
Yeah.
So, that was like one of my go-to when we went to the video store. That was something that I probably rented like hundreds of times. That was like my, one of my all-time favorite films as a kid to get at the video store on VHS, for those of you who know what that is.
I remember sitting, the theater was so packed, I had to sit in the aisle because no one would let me sit next to them.
That's horrible.
It was 1997 when it came out, so I don't know, how old was I then? I was 14 years old. I'm probably too young for that, right? That's rated R, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, that's definitely rated R.
And I don't know if you've heard, but Spawn number 300 came out this week, which is, you know, iconic. It's a milestone issue. And Todd McFarlane, though, has said repeatedly, and Image Comics keeps reminding us, that with issue number 301, they'll make history as the longest running creator-owned character for a comic book series. The news I want to talk about is they introduced a new Spawn, and her name is She-Spawn. She-Spawn.
What? How do you feel about that?
One of our coworkers at AIPT on Slack said, "Well, it's just like Lady Deadpool," and I don't agree. I feel like She-Spawn is like trying to needle and annoy people who might be offended by such a thing. Personally, it doesn't offend me, but I think it's the dumbest sounding and looking name. Just doesn't make sense.
I'm looking at the panel right now, and it just looks dumb.
Yeah.
Like Lady Deadpool, it just sounds cool. Like,
right.
It works, but She Spawn does not work. Lady Spawn, I would have liked that better. I don't know that it flows as well as something like Lady Deadpool, but She-Spawn is just awful.
There's like some class to the lady, but with She, it's like, it's just forcing the fact that she's female on us for some reason. Like it matters like that much. I don't know.
I will say I do like the costume a lot.
Yeah, it looks cool. I think, was that page drawn by J. Scott Campbell?
It was.
Yeah, he did a portion of the book. Did you get the chance to read the book?
I didn't get to read it. I just saw the comic subreddit losing their minds over She-Spawn and had to dive in.
just to go back to Spawn number 300 really quick. There's a really weird thing at the end of the book. Todd McFarlane writes a little letter to us, and then he has this breakdown of every story with which was drawn by a different artist. And it says, Greg Capullo chapter. This chapter shows... And then he goes on. And then Todd McFarlane chapter. This chapter shows. And he does that every single time. This chapter shows. This chapter shows. This chapter shows. It is so bizarre to me that he felt the need to explain to us why it mattered to the bigger story.
Do you think like that was actually important to him, or that he felt like because it was the 300th issue, he had to just like fill it with stuff?
Well, it's all leading to 301. So I feel like this last letter is like, if you like this at all or didn't read, here's my reasoning for why you need to read 301 or something. He's a salesman. Anyway, moving on. On this show, we talked a little bit, I think 2 weeks ago, about how, spoilers, in the last Batman issue, spoilers, Alfred gets his neck broken and Bane snaps it. And it got the internet a flutter. Their hearts were a flutter. And Forrest and I talked about how this was poorly placed. It was sort of like for shock, and it didn't really matter to the character or the story. It was almost insulting to the character. Well, Tom King on Twitter came out and said, I'm writing a scene and it involves Alfred. So I think it basically confirms Alfred's not dead, but this is comics. No one is ever dead, is it?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't been keeping up with Batman. I hear City of Bane is great. But I just can't keep up with it right now. I have too much on my plate. But when I heard about like the circumstances surrounding it, I didn't understand the uproar because of what you just said. It's comic books.
Right.
Batman's been killed. Hal Jordan's been killed. Barry Allen, Clark Kent, like all these people have died. They come back. Like, what are you worried about?
I
figure it's going to be either like some touching story about how much Alfred has sacrificed and loves Bruce, or it's just going to be like, just kidding, he's actually fine.
Right. I mean, the story involves Batman's dad coming from another dimension, and he was Batman in this other dimension. So, like, for all we know, he snapped Alfred of the other dimension's neck. And then who cares about that, right?
There you go. It's going to be like Endgame. It's a different Gamora.
Speaking of deaths, though, Marvel has put out three promos this week with the big capitalized letters, incoming, with an exclamation point. And they are basically hyping this murder mystery, what appears to be a murder mystery, as in the copy it says, can you solve the puzzle before the heroes of the Marvel Universe? And it's coming out December 26th. In the three images, one, in the very first, there is a dead body under a white sheet. So whoever that is, they're probably not going to stay dead. Unless they're not a hero, then I guess they could die forever.
So on the, I've seen two. What's the third one? I saw the one with the Fantastic Four and Iron Man.
Yep.
And then I saw the one with Apocalypse and Magneto and Professor Xavier. What was the third one?
The third one had Daredevil and Jessica Jones, and then what looks like the character wearing the Eternity Mask, which was the big thing behind Marvel Comics number 1000. The Eternity Mask shows up throughout that issue, an 88-page issue, and at the very end, it hypes that we will learn more about this. He looks like a cowboy with a black cosmic mask. And he's in that third promo.
Also, maybe it's just like the perspective that's getting me, but on the preview image with Fantastic Four and Iron Man, I feel like the body looks super small compared to everyone else.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. Yeah, so like a child maybe.
Yeah, but like who?
But then the gurney the body is on actually ends, so as if it's the full size of the gurney. So I don't know. It's confusing.
What if it's a child size gurney?
Maybe it's just a giant cheese grater.
And they're going to grate the body.
Yeah, man. It's Wakandian cuisine. That's why Black Panther's in the bottom right, because he's getting ready with his spices.
he's there to serve.
Exactly.
Serve them all dinner. Welcome to Wakanda. Let's eat this guy.
Something else we should eat are the rich, because in our next bit of news, Jody Hauser actually... she took this clip from a news article. I'm not sure from where. Basically, it's talking about the U.S. trade. Yes, that's right. U.S. trade at the Comics Podcast. Basically, starting September 1st, there's going to be a 10% tariff on China and Hong Kong for books. And this might affect, in her words, it might affect RPGs and comics. Right. So in our next bit of news, Tom Taylor has basically been hinting that he's jumping on a new DC book soon, and he's been hashtagging Squad Goals DC. Everyone is assuming he means Suicide Squad, which would be pretty cool, especially with the Harley movie coming out. It would line up. Not that Harley is necessarily the main character, but she is one of the biggest in the team. Are you excited for this?
I'll be honest. I've never really got into the Suicide Squad books. I think... the movie just kind of killed all interest I had in them.
Yeah.
The last oh my God. Time
we went to that movie together and you fell asleep during the movie. I did. Do you remember I tried to wake you up? I'm like, you're going to miss it. And you were like, no, it's fine.
Yeah. I remember Lisa being like, dude, you slept through it. And I was like, yeah, it's all right. I didn't miss anything.
You were like, the nap was better.
Yeah, it really was. And I was like, so amped for that.
Yeah.
I stick to this day, the trailer was better than the movie. Like, the trailer made it look like it was going to be so awesome and so fun, and then it was just terrible.
For sure, yeah.
I think the last time I was really interested in Suicide Squad was when Captain Boomerang killed Tim Drake's father, and then his son took up the mantle, and there was, like, a new Suicide Squad after that.
I don't remember that.
It was it's that famous panel. It's attached to some event. I can't remember off the top of my head what it was, but it's that famous panel with Tim wrapped up in Batman's cowl, and it says Batman and Robin orphans. It's like a really good panel. It always sticks out in my mind as like one of my favorite Batman and Robin panels.
Nice. Yeah, I feel like Tom Taylor could probably nail it. He did such a great job with X-Men Red, and the team dynamics there. He's sure to do a good job. It kind of worries me, though, with Deceased and now this, it's like he's doing more DC than he is Marvel. Not that he isn't doing Marvel, but maybe he's leaning in that direction. I don't want him to see him like get off Spider-Man and stuff, you know?
I don't know. I've been loving Deceased so much, and I'm more of a DC reader. So selfishly, I'd be okay with that.
There you go. All right. Two heads of a coin right there. In our last bit of news, I don't know if you know this, but New York Comic Con is coming up. Well, Marvel has unveiled their panel lineup, which, let's be honest, they they have the best panels as far as comic related newsworthy panels to go to, which include Marvel's Next Big Thing. And this year they have a Dawn of X panel, which everyone has to go to that. I mean,
yeah, Chris is losing his mind over that as we speak.
I'm sure. Jonathan Hickman's run on House of X and Powers of 10 has been excellent. And I guess Tini Howard is going to be manning that panel, and which is exciting. She's doing Marauders, I think.
What is she doing? I forget. I'm actually the person that put this article together.
For Excalibur. Comics. No. She's doing Excalibur.
So I should know this, but.
And then Ed Brisson's going to be there, Benjamin Percy, who they're doing X-Force for Percy and New Mutants for Ed Brisson. That will be exciting. There's other panels too, like Women of Marvel on Sunday.
The Heroes Project, they've been talking up a lot too. It's basically about real people doing, you know, it's an unscripted series about people doing remarkable things and creating positive change in their communities. So it's cool. I like that they're doing something about just, you know, real world people that are doing good things. It's like a feel good panel, and they don't have to do that. Like, they're not obligated to do anything about that. They're there to talk about comic books. So I like that they're highlighting people in their communities that are, you know, inflicting positive change. I feel like so many of the things we see on the news, it's just like, this is bad and this is bad and this is bad. So it's cool to see a company highlighting regular people just doing positive things. I really like that. I don't know that I'll have any time to go to it because I'm going to have to go to the Next Big Thing panel. And I kind of want to go to the Marvel games, but I mean, Dawn of X, there's just so much good stuff here. Donnie Cates actually retweeted this when I threw it up on Twitter and said, like, you guys really don't want to miss the Next Big Things panel. It's going to be crazy. So I was like, okay, now I have to go.
Yeah, that's always the biggest one. I covered it at San Diego Comic-Con this last July. And do you remember when I was tweeting? Like, the Twitter practically broke.
I had to turn off notifications on my Twitter app on my phone because I was like, what is Dave doing? And then I saw and I was like, oh, my God.
So if you listen to this podcast and like this podcast, I highly recommend you follow AIPT on Twitter, which is AIPT Comics, because we will be live tweeting most of these panels. And you can get that news right as it happens.
Yeah. Part of my role as our event coordinator is I coordinate our events, including Comic-Con. So we'll have a team of 12 people at New York Comic-Con this year. Last year we had 7. So expect a lot of news out of us, a lot of live tweeting, a lot of articles, a lot of interviews. It's going to be awesome. I'm super excited. It's my favorite con to go to every year.
Yeah, me too. I can't wait to see what you guys cook up. It's going to be great. Well, that's it for news, folks. I hope you liked that segment because it's gone. It's done. It's dead. And now it's time for top books of last week, our favorite two books that came out last week. To start this segment, we always talk about comicbookroundup.com, which is basically the Rotten Tomatoes of comic book reviewing. And we talk about, well, we list off what the top critic pick was, which was Crowded number 9. Which was actually reviewed at aptcomics.com. I highly recommend you check that out. Ronnie Gorham reviewed it, and he gave it a good score, let me tell you. And then also, the fan pick was House of X number 4. No surprise there. It had 47 reviews last I checked. People are really digging this stuff. So because we have David Popos on later on the show, we're going to reduce our second pick to one sentence. One sentence that sums up why we liked it. So, JJ, I'm going to let you kick it off. What was your second favorite book of last week?
House of X. So, mine is two sentences. I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
There's only two words in the second sentence, though.
Okay, good. I'll allow it.
Do you like Archangel, Husk, Cyclops, Jean Grey, Wolverine, Nightcrawler? Well, fuck.
Yeah, it's not good for them. It's a shocking issue. To say the least.
That's one way to put it.
So my second favorite book was Fantastic Four number 14, written by Dan Slott with art by Paco Medina. And I'm going to be taking this from my review, which is on aptcomics.com, which reads, a love letter to their origin story while diving headlong into a new space adventure. This is a great story for new and old readers alike. It's the start of a new arc, and I highly recommend it.
That was two sentences.
No, well, the last bit, I was like, that was like not part of it. That was just me, like, you know,
I'm just trying to hold you accountable.
That was a segue to, what is your favorite book of last week?
Something is Killing the Children, number one, by James Tynion IV and Werther Del Edera. So I love horror. I'm going to be heading up our 31 Days of Halloween event starting October 1st. Please come to aiptcomics.com if you like horror. It's going to be awesome. We're going to do a ton of fun stuff. You're going to love it. Anyways, when I first heard about this book and then I heard James on the podcast with you, I think that was what, 2 weeks ago?
It was.
Yeah, that was great. It just kept getting me hyped and super excited. And every so often you get overhyped for a book and then it lets you down. That did not happen here. This book is utterly fantastic. I love everything about it. The colors, the pencils, the writing. I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but sure. I just feel like there's so many hooks here. Like, it really grabbed me with the art. It grabbed me with just like the nostalgia of being a kid and being afraid and having friends and the things you do with them to impress them. And it really caught me by surprise. If you're squeamish, this book might not be for you. I'll just say that.
Yeah, it's graphic.
Yeah, but just so good. I was kind of legitimately a little mad when the issue was over because I was like, that's it, I have to wait.
Yeah, and it's an ongoing now, so we have a lot more in store for us.
Yeah, it was only supposed to be 6 issues, so congratulations to that creative team. That's awesome.
For sure. I really liked it, too. It wasn't my number one pick, but funny enough, James Tynion IV also wrote the book I liked. Guy's just on fire, I guess.
Yeah, good job, James.
So my book was Justice League number 31, which was written by Tynion and Scott Snyder, with art by Jorge Jimenez. This is the second part of the big Justice Doom War arc, and things now have been established in issue 31, so we can kind of get a move on with each plot and subplot, which includes Flash and Green Lantern in the past, Batman, Wonder Woman, and Superman, the Trinity, in the future, and then Mara and all the other heroes in the now trying to basically save the universe from Lex Luthor and Perpetua, who are trying to turn everything evil.
Yeah. I was reading it when Sinestro and the, like, what spectrum was it? The ultraviolet, was that it?
That sounds right.
Yeah, that's the last time that I was reading the book. I just, like, I've been wanting to read it so badly, but it's so big and there's so many crazy things happening that I know I have to go in order, and I just, like, haven't had the time. But I was reading things about it, and I had, can we say spoilers for it? Is that okay?
Sure, yeah, it's Sunday, so.
I saw that the Anti-Monitor was in it, and the last I saw of him, he was like a burned out husk that was inside a giant black lantern. Mm-hmm. So what's going on with that?
Funny you should ask. Everyone's been looking for him. He's the third brother of the sons of Perpetua, and they need to band together with the heroes in order to save the universe. And so when we see him, this is the very last page of this issue, he shows up and he seems to be ordering Aquaman around. And we also haven't seen him in this storyline since last summer in the Drowned Earth event.
Which was great. He sacrificed himself at the end of that to kill, like, that anti-life Kraken thing, right?
Yep.
So apparently he ended up hanging out with the Anti-Monitor after that somehow.
he knows his, like, cosmic roots now, so he realizes things the Justice League could never understand, probably, or something. I don't know.
Cool.
It's like really layered storytelling. I keep saying this in every single review. I probably should stop reviewing it because I keep saying the same things. But it's huge in scope, but also the best bang for your buck of any comic, I think, out there. Because there's always some laugh out loud moments. There's always good action. The art is obviously some of the best art DC's putting out every week. And on top of that, there's exposition and backstory. And it's just very, very big. And every issue feels like it probably, from another publisher, could have been stretched to 3 or 4 issues. It's that dense.
And you see Aquaman and the Anti-Monitor hanging out together. So, like, when is that ever going to be a thing? Like, who would ever be like, yeah, that's a good idea?
Yeah, true.
But apparently Snyder's making it work somehow.
Yeah, and Tynion. Don't forget Tynion.
Oh, yeah. My bad.
Yeah, how dare you, sir? How dare you?
Sorry, James.
So, okay, that's it for that segment. Next segment, top books for next week, we pick the number one book we're looking forward to that's coming out next week. And this is where we get to basically talk about the books that are coming out September 11th. I'm going to go first. I can't wait for Riddler, Year of the Villain number one. This is written by Mark Russell with art by Scott Godlewski. And first of all, Mark Russell, I don't think he's written a bad story since he started writing comics. He did the very famous and acclaimed Flintstones series a couple years ago. Everything he writes has some connection or some commentary on society as a whole. And it always gets you thinking. It always feels like it's important in some way. And I'm really excited to see how he will take Riddler and do a single story. He did a Sinestro story in this Year of the Villain summer as well. And that one was just jam-packed with a story that could have been an entire like movie following Sinestro as he kind of tries to take care of these aliens, which was high concept sci-fi stuff.
Yeah, I read that and I was like, this could be a series.
Oh, you did? Nice. Yeah, it was really good, right?
Yeah, I thought it was fantastic.
And then Godlewski, he's done some horror work that I've really liked in the past at Image Comics. And I don't know, he has a really, it was a book called The Dark and Bloody that I'm thinking about. He has a really good handle on storytelling in a smaller sense. So I think it'll really work with Riddler, which will probably be a darker character-driven story. What was your, what's your most anticipated book for next week?
So this was hard for me because there's a bunch of stuff coming out that I'm excited to read. But I ended up settling on, after much debate, Coffinbound number 2. So this is being written by Dan Waters. There was so much hype for this book before it came out. I don't know if you caught any of that, but like every creator out there got a copy of this book. I feel like it was kind of like Something is Killing the Children. Like I feel like all the creators were going crazy for this book.
Mm.
And it's just so different from what I was expecting and just so different from anything I've ever read before. And he kind of explains at the end of the first issue, like why that is to a degree. But it's almost like you're just kind of reading a big poem in a way. But it's also a horror book. And there's just so many things in this world that happen that there's really no explanation of. You're just kind of dropped into things. He's not really taking the time to explain anything to you. It's just, it's happening. You're along for the ride and you need to figure it out. And I saw some reviewers really didn't like it. And I feel like this is one of those books that either clicks with you or it doesn't. But the artwork is also just gorgeous. I love it. The artist is simply Danny. I'm not really familiar with anything that they've done before. But it's a gorgeous, gorgeous book. And the covers as well are just fantastic. It's like fantasy horror and, yeah, as I said, it's just kind of like reading a big poem. It's just super cool. I can't say enough good things about it.
Nice, yeah. That sounds awesome. You got to check it out, folks. JJ says so, and he might not be on the show for a long time. So do him a solid. Read that book.
I'm dropping my little nuggets of knowledge while I'm here, guys. Appreciate
boom,
them.
Boom, boom. So at our next segment, Judging by the Cover Junior, this is where we pick our favorite cover art for one single book. It's all modeled after Eric Klein's fantastic column, Judging by the Cover. And JJ, what was your favorite cover that's coming out on September 11th?
So I went with Absolute Carnage, Symbiote of Vengeance, number one. This cover is just like pure rock and roll to me. Like, as a dude that really digs metal and stoner rock and fire and just demons and stuff, this just spoke to me. It's Ghost Rider on his motorcycle. And it looks like he's dragging another Ghost Rider behind him. And then there's the Carnage God in the background with flames coming out of his eyes. And like the bike is right up in your face. And Symbiote of Vengeance is like dripping, you know, symbiote goop, whatever you call that. And then it's black and shiny and there's fire. It's just fucking badass.
Nice. Yeah. I love the idea of it in part because I know Carnage doesn't get hurt by fire anymore, but the mix of a Ghost Rider and a symbiote doesn't make sense in a sense because fire is such a weakness to symbiotes.
Yeah, but apparently former Ghost Rider Alejandra Jones had a symbiote at one point.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that. So Johnny Blaze and Danny Ketch and Alejandra are trying to fight Carnage God. No, that's his name, right?
Yep. K-N-U-L-L.
I don't even really care what's going on here. I just saw the cover and I was like, that's fucking awesome.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, it's a horror series, so if it's metal, it's working. My favorite cover is for the Batman Eternal Omnibus. It's by Dustin Nguyen, and it is a cover that is so pretty. It's got Batman framed on his right with this yellow, just starkly yellow backdrop, which is actually made up of his cape, and then there are bats flying right at us. On his left is this dark blue sky and Arkham at his feet, and he's sort of standing in the entryway of Arkham Asylum with the sign behind him. It's just very moody and atmospheric. I don't know what this omnibus is actually collecting, and I don't really care. The cover art's pretty dope. So if you go to AIPTcomics.com and go to this posting, you can see it. You can also see it on the podcast icon itself on Apple or wherever you are listening to this podcast. So who's interested in talking to David about going to the chapel number one?
I am.
Okay, well, here he comes. All right, so we have David Pepposan, and he just came out with a fantastic book called Going to the Chapel Number One. He wrote it. The art is by Gavin Goodry. And David, thanks for being on the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
We want to ask you a few questions about Going to the Chapel. First of all, though, Patton Oswalt,
yeah,
randomly, without you telling him to, tweeted, yeah, that your book is sick and great.
That was, the whole day was very surreal. You and I talked about this before we started recording, but I was actually in the hospital with a kidney stone the night before our book dropped. So I spent all night in the ER, promptly passed the stone, and then went to a signing. And then in the middle of that signing, Patton Oswalt tweeted about our book. And I couldn't be more surprised or grateful. I'm a huge Patton Oswalt fan, and he and I actually spoke a little bit afterwards. I sent him the rest of the book, and he was very excited to read it. And it just kind of goes to show that sometimes indie books can get super lucky. I believe that he probably saw we'd gotten some coverage over in Nerdist earlier that morning. So I that is my hypothesis of how Patton discovered the book. But it just kind of blew my mind. It certainly destroyed my Twitter and Facebook and Instagram for the next 48 hours. Such a wonderful endorsement. He gave us permission. We are going to be using that on our trade paperback.
He's on a couple too. He puts quotes on books here and there, like DC, Marvel, mostly indie, but yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, dude.
So
congrats.
Yeah, no, thank you. It just goes to show that a lot of people told me when we were pitching this book around that there was no room for romantic comedies in the direct market, and I'm glad that Patton has proven them wrong.
So tell those people who don't know, what is this book about?
Sure. Going to the Chapel is the story of a gang of bank robbers who thinks it would be easier to rob rich people's weddings than it would be to rob banks. They're going to find out just how wrong they are. I've been likening the book to if Die Hard got hitched to Wedding Crashers, or if Reservoir Dogs had a baby with Arrested Development and then chose to bring that baby to a wedding. I felt like romantic comedies got a bad rap in the direct market and in pop culture as a whole. And so I wanted to write a rom-com that I thought everybody would like.
So, okay, on the cover it reads, "Love is the ultimate hostage situation." And David, I have to ask, who hurt you?
It was one of those things. The inspiration behind Going to the Chapel is actually not what you think. It's not about a bad breakup, I swear. It's about a horrible wedding. I was the best man at my oldest friend's wedding, and I was the worst best man in history. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. The bachelor party that I planned was just cursed from top to bottom, down to the Airbnb was trashed. I thought it'd be cute if we rented some like inflatable sumo suits, the backyard. Did not know the backyard was at a 45 degree angle.
Oh no.
And then some groomsmen bailed at the last second because they decided they did not want to pay their share anymore. And then finally, sort of the cherry on top is I actually wound up going to the hospital with a kidney stone. And so I missed the whole bachelor party. I had to troubleshoot it from the wrong side of the country.
I think you get stress kidney stones.
Stress, yeah. Kidney stones. So, as I was sort of recovering on these painkillers, I thought to myself, well, at least it didn't happen during the wedding. And then I thought, but what if it did? And that was sort of how this book came into being. You know, Going to the Chapel, it is about Emily Anderson, who is a wealthy bride grappling with a serious case of cold feet. And before she can say anything, her wedding is taken over by a group of bank robbers known as the Bad Elvis Gang. Unfortunately, Emily's dysfunctional family turns what should have been a simple smash and grab into a full-blown standoff with the police. And Emily's going to become kind of this unlikely ringleader of her own hostage situation to try to get out of walking down the aisle. And all these things just came from, what's the worst thing that could happen at my friend's wedding? I thought, you know, if the father of the bride had hired some leg breakers to keep my friend from marrying his only child, that would have been pretty bad. But then I realized, no, it would be worse if his fiance just had second thoughts. And I realized that there is a real emotional arc that you can kind of delve into with this. I think pop culture as a whole tends to treat love and marriage and romance as a destination rather than a journey. And so for our story, we kind of wanted to show, you know, what's the swerves look like? Sometimes they're bank robbers. Sometimes it's your family being weird. Sometimes it's you being locked in chapel with the SWAT team outside. But, you know, love is it's a more complicated emotion than I think people tend to give it credit for. And so it was something that I really wanted to explore in this book, especially in a medium that already doesn't do a whole lot of favors to romance as a whole.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Is karma's reward for you getting kidney stones?
Go ahead. I thought to myself when I went to the hospital, I said, you know, honestly, this is poetry. You know, this book started with a kidney stone and now it's being born with a kidney stone. I feel like, you know, at this rate, I'm sure I'll have a third one dropping when the trade hits. And it's one of those things, the universe has a sense of humor, and I've come to learn, especially working in the comics industry. There's so much that is out of your control. And, you know, there's that phrase that, you know, when man plans, God laughs. I think about that a lot and sort of, you know, you can try to do anything you want to do, but the universe tends to throw you curveballs when you least expect it. And honestly, I always say I live for the story, and going to the ER, then getting tweeted by Patton Oswalt and doing back-to-back signings with about 2 hours of sleep. That's a story I'm going to be dining on for the rest of my life.
It's like karma.
Yeah, I don't know how you're going to forget that.
No, I mean, you know, all I'll say is thank God for painkillers. I felt like the dinosaur that didn't know his body was dead yet. I just kind of stood there, and thankfully I know my pitch pretty well. And so I was making some sales, but I was thinking to myself, I was like, wow, it's a good thing I can't feel my feet right now. I'd be dead right now. So,
I was going to say, I'm amazed you were able to go to the signing. I've had one kidney stone, and it put me out of action for like 2 days. The pain was, dislocated a shoulder and, oof, you know, gotten stitches. But this like redefined my understanding of what pain was.
Yep. This was actually my fourth kidney stone. I've had four. Thankfully, I'm pretty sure it was a small one. But, you know, it's one of those things that I love selling comics, and I love trying to go as far above and beyond the call of duty as I can. And I wear this as a badge of honor. I was tweeting later that day. I said, comics editors, know this. Nothing will stop me from selling comics. So keep hiring me for work. So, yes, I say I always try to con for the jobs I want, not the jobs I have. And I'm not going to let something like a kidney stone sideline me from a book release. No way, no how.
At this rate, I'm wondering if you're trying to become a doctor because you're in the hospital so much.
I know, right? My father's actually he's an eye surgeon, I'm the oldest of four, and I think he kind of gets tired of us all calling him in the middle of the night because we're on separate coasts from him. And I'm sure he gets sick of us calling him in the middle of the night being like, hey, I got a kidney stone, or hey, like I fell down some stairs, or hey, I'm in the hospital for XYZ reason. I think at this point he's just going to disconnect his phone and just, you know, go into witness protection or something.
So I saw, you know, at the very opening of the comic, you know, Chapel of Love was credited, and then there it is. It's the first thing we see. So was the song tied to this because of the title, or is it like, what's the connection between you, the song, and this book?
Sure. Well, you know, when I was coming up with the book, I thought the idea of a hostage heist story during a wedding, that was sort of the initial kernel of the concept. And I thought, you know, what's kind of like a cool, stylish title that I could think of for it. And Going to the Chapel popped up pretty quickly because I feel like there's a lot of layers to it. You know, you've got, the bad Elvis gang. They are going to the chapel to try to steal a $250 million necklace. You have the cops who are trying to get into the chapel so they can arrest these men. But you also have Emily, who, you know, she's dealing with cold feet and she's got this fear of commitment. So in a lot of ways, that's the metaphor. She is also trying to get herself to the chapel in a way. And so, you know, with the idea of the song lyrics, of course, because it's a song that everybody knows. So I reached out to Hal Leonard LLC, which is a company that often acts as the intermediary for asking for song rights. And so I actually had to send them the whole first issue script for their approval to say, hey, here's the script. These were the lyrics that we were thinking of. Are you cool with this? And so, I have a contract sitting in my inbox that I had to countersign down to I have to send them a copy of the first issue, sort of as a courtesy. Thankfully it was a relatively painless process. My friend Rylan Grant, who writes Aberrant and Banjax over at Action Lab, he tends to use a lot of song lyrics in his work, and so he kind of clued me in on what the process was for that sort of thing. And I thought, especially, you know, at the beginning of our first issue, my last book, Spencer and Locke, you know, it was a detective noir story, so we had a lot of narrative captions to sort of get us in Detective Locke's head. And I kind of wanted to try the opposite approach with this book. I didn't want any narrative captions. You know, I kind of wanted the characters' motivations to be a little bit more of a mystery to readers. And I wanted to just streamline my writing down as much as humanly possible. I wanted to see how little could I write to get the maximum impact. And so for the opening five pages, all we've got are the lyrics to Going to the Chapel. And I thought it was a cool effect, because not only does it sort of drum up a certain type of mood and atmosphere, because you see the bad Elvis gang, you know, putting on their masks and getting their shotguns ready, and you see Emily kind of walking down the aisle in a way that looks almost more like a funeral than a wedding. But it's a cool way to introduce sound into a medium that's naturally silent, like comics.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've never seen that in a comic before. It stuck out to me immediately as something that was really cool and unique.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, like, it's stuck in your head from the jump. And you know exactly, everybody knows what that song sounds like. And so by the time you sort of get to our big, you know, double page credits page, you're humming along with it. You can't escape it. It's an earworm. And, it was a little bit of a nod to old school Tarantino. The man knows how to place a needle drop like nobody's business. And but I just also thought, I was like, yeah, I don't see comics starting that way, so this would be kind of a cool way to try things. I'm always about trying to tinker around with storytelling and trying to take whatever kind of risk I can with it. And this one I think really paid off.
It's funny that you say Tarantino, because I was talking to Dave before the show, and this is actually the next question I have for you. But when I was reading it, I was like, I think part of why I like this so much is because I feel like a very Tarantino Kill Bill and like even a little bit of like a Point Break vibe, if you feel
like
that.
Yeah, I love
me some Patrick Swayze. So
me too.
You know, I think you kind of answered my question, though. So those are definitely like influences for you. Like, what else were you drawing from? Because the characters are also like so, like, they just grab you. Like the grizzled like grandmother just made me immediately think of Bill with that like wry smile and attitude.
So there were a lot of influences, both fictional and real life, that went into Going to the Chapel. Like you said, Tarantino is a big influence on me in general. While I'd say, you know, this book isn't nearly as bloody as a Tarantino, as most Tarantino movies. I love the way that he plays with rhythm and sort of is able to balance action and a sense of humor. And the way that he plays with pacing and structure and time, which is something that we did with our time breaks, Point Break as well. I love that movie. And the Dead Presidents were a huge influence on the Bad Elvis Gang. because I liked the idea of criminals with a shtick. And so I thought, you know, what's some wedding imagery that would lend itself well to a gang of bank robbers? And I thought of the quickie weddings in Las Vegas with the Elvis impersonators. And so I thought, okay, like bad Elvis gang, you know, we've got Tom, who's his alias is King. He's sort of young Elvis. We have Vegas, who is supposed to be fat Elvis. We have Motown, who is our African-American Elvis. And we have Romero, who is our dead zombie Elvis.
That's so awesome.
It was one of those things at the time I was like, well, if nothing else, somebody will see a zombie on the cover and maybe we'll get a couple Walking Dead fans. But, you know, there are tons of other influences. The biggest influences on this, there's Die Hard, of course. Dog Day Afternoon was a huge influence on this book. I love that movie. It's about a bank robbery that goes horribly wrong. And the thing I loved in particular was seeing the lines being blurred between the hostages and the hostage takers. There was a lot of comedy to that. Seeing like Al Pacino, who's, you know, he's taken this whole bank of bank tellers hostage, and suddenly they're kind of like palling around a little bit, and like his hostages are like fully in support of him. And so by the time the cops actually show up and try to drag him out, he's like shouting Attica on the street, and like everybody in the street is like cheering for him. I thought that was like that was a very funny thing. Visually, we also talked about a lot of influences. Gavin Guidry and I, we talked about Breaking Bad. We talked about Hell or High Water. We talked about Baby Driver and other Edgar Wright movies. You know, we kind of wanted to get a little bit of that Western flair to it visually, just because, you know, some of it was just, you know, just a stylistic choice, but some of it was also very pragmatic, because if you get into a hostage situation in the middle of a city, things get really complicated, because then you suddenly have, I mean, the cops can just bust in pretty much at a moment's notice, and you can kind of have snipers shoot in. And whereas, you know, this is a sleepy chapel that's kind of in a small town. And so, you know, there isn't that police infrastructure out there. So it kind of makes it a little bit more of an even fight, I guess. And it makes the book, it gives it its own unique flavor, I think.
I have to say, it's a very clean looking book. How did you hook up with Gavin and colorist Liz Kramer?
Yeah, so Gavin, so this goes to show you how long it takes for books to come together, or at least my books to come together. I connected with Gavin in May of 2017. So it was right around when the first issue of Spencer and Locke Volume 1 was coming out. That's how far back I've been working on this book. And my younger siblings were graduating college. I remember my younger siblings are triplets, so I did a three college tour in the span of a week and a half. And I found Gavin on Twitter while I was traveling from couch to couch. And he had just completed his book, The Night Driver. It was a one-shot over at Comixology. And I was really struck by the way that Gavin could switch gears so seamlessly between this very kind of gritty, stylish action and then this very expressive comedy. You know, there I remember distinctly a page of a guy just like flossing his teeth while sitting at somebody's desk, and like somebody desperately resisting the urge to choke him behind him. And so, yeah, I reached out to Gavin pretty quickly, and he was looking for more work at the time. And so, you know, the timing really worked out. Liz, on the other hand, it took us a while to get Liz on the book. You know, my philosophy is having the right colorist on a book is what makes or breaks what you're going to read. A good colorist will elevate any art, but having the wrong colorist will just handicap even the best artists. And so we had worked with a number of different colorists in the pitch stage for Going to the Chapel. And you know, either due to sort of stylistic things or the timing, the scheduling didn't work out. But we were kind of hard up for a colorist for a while. And Mara Jane Carpenter, who is the colorist on Jade Street Protection Services, she had originally been slated to work on the book. And due to scheduling, she had just started a grad school program. She wasn't able to continue on the book. But she had introduced me to Liz. She had introduced me at C2E2 the previous year. And Liz had been giving out mini comics of her webcomic Threader. And I was just blown away that her use of color. She loves using pinks and purples, especially, which I thought would be a really cool technique.
Yeah, it's a lot of those. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she's got such a lovely sense of texture to her work, which I don't think you usually see in most books. And so she immediately nailed it. And she's so literate when it comes to color influences. You know, she and I, we talked a lot about Matt Wilson's work on Black Widow. We talked about Patricia Martine's work on Secret Weapons, especially Patricia's work on, you know, using like accent colors to kind of like tell different scenes and have different atmospheres. And Liz kind of took all these influences and kind of shoved them in a blender and really made them her own. I think she's our secret weapon. I think the book doesn't look anything like anything else on the stands because of Liz. I'm already working on another book with Liz. That's how much I enjoyed working with her. So she's just really kind of, she's terrific. Ariana Mayer, also, I want to give her a shout out, our letterer. You know, I usually work with Colin Bell, who is my letterer on Spencer and Locke. And based on the production schedule, it became very clear that I had to keep Colin on Spencer and Locke. He didn't have time to do both books at once. And I had seen Ariana's work on Nancy Drew over at Dynamite. And I thought it was such a very irreverent and bouncy kind of way that she did her letters. And so it made a lot of the jokes really pop. And so she was terrific. You know, Ariana's sort of the veteran of the group, I think. And so she was able to sort of tap me on the shoulder from time to time and be like, hey, these are what the production specs are supposed to look like. Or, you know, here's why you should do X, Y, and Z. And so it was very good having sort of that seasoned hand to turn to. And, you know, my favorite thing is working with the letter. You know, I consider letters to be almost like they're to comics what film editors are to film. You know, because there's the movie you write and the movie you shoot and the movie you edit. And I think for comics, there's the comic you write and the comic you draw and then the comic you get lettered. And so there were a couple of last minute swerves that Ariana helped me make in the lettering stage. We killed a couple of characters off panel thanks to Ariana.
Nice.
I'm sure readers will figure it out. It's nobody who's in the book. It's not like I just introduced a character and then I killed them off screen. But there were a couple of people that I was like, oh, we probably should have mentioned these people. Well, it's too late. They're not in the book. So let's just mention that they're dead now. And so, yes, Ariana and I will always share that body count. I think it just goes to show that, you know, while I think there were a lot of publishers who were very, you know, and I think by design, publishers are very conservative. They want to minimize their risk. They want to make sure that they don't bet the house on a book that can't sell. But I think the market can be very different. And I think the reason why we got all these really top tier artists working on covers for the book is I told them about the high concept and they all went crazy about it. They were all like, that is such a funny, fun concept. And like I was saying, they're like, yeah, nobody does rom-coms in the direct market. Why is that? And I'm there are plenty of demographic reasons, of course. You know, I mean, there are guys who love superhero books and they love sci-fi and fantasy. And trust me, I love all those books as well. And I think rom-coms in particular get a bad rap because guys feel their masculinity is being threatened and women feel like their ability to be taken seriously is threatened. And so a lot of people won't admit it, or they will as sort of a guilty pleasure. And my philosophy is, you know, romance is a great way to establish stakes in a way that doesn't involve killing somebody. But on top of that, you know, some of my favorite movies, you think of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, you think of About Time, you think 500 Days of Summer, you think even sort of older movies, you know, like Chasing Amy or When Harry Met Sally, they've all shared the same romantic foundation. And I think, you know, there are a lot of guys probably listening to this podcast who are like, oh, I don't know about this rom-com book. This is a rom-com book with a really fun heist twist to it. And it's something that, you know, I've been calling it the ultimate date night comic, but I think it's a book that anybody can enjoy.
You know, Spencer and Locke is a noir crime. This is a romantic crime drama thriller. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other genres you want to tackle and explore?
Yeah, tons, tons. I'm working actually on a sci-fi book over with Top Cow right now called Grand Theft Astro. We announced it at San Diego Comic-Con last year, and I'm in the middle of, I think, the second to last script now. And that's sort of it's like Fast and the Furious meets Back to the Future in space. It's set in a world where people are no longer racing cars or horses; they're racing spaceships. And how one sort of space racer, he accidentally tears open a wormhole in time and falls 7 years into the future.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah, you know, so it's a little Flight of the Navigator. And so he winds up having to go on a heist with his formerly younger brother, who is now older than him, and has grown up to become sort of a crime boss. And they go on a heist to pick up a piece of technology that might be able to bring him home. So that I'm really excited to do some sci-fi. I've got a fantasy pitch that we're looking to find the right home for. We had a publisher actually reach out to me right after Fan Expo Boston, saying how much they loved our pitch pages. So I've got fingers crossed that that'll find a home soon, because we've got a really terrific art team attached to that.
You mentioned you're working on a book with Liz. Which book is that?
You know, it's not too much of a spoiler to say, that's our fantasy pitch.
Cool.
Liz is working on a fantasy pitch. And so, you know, I really want to tackle sci-fi. I really want to tackle some fantasy. I'd love to do some horror. I've got a few horror ideas that I've been kind of working on off and on. But you know, crime is kind of my first love. I do love crime books. I think
if any police officers are listening,
I love crime books. Crime books. Okay.
This man likes crime. Listening.
I like writing crime fiction. There's something about the genre that's very accessible, I think, because you don't have to, you know, explain the world around you. And the stakes are automatically very high and they're very human. And for me, it's sort of, I love seeing dysfunctional characters trying to sort of pull off either pull off a score or try to prevent a score. There's always stakes involved, whether you're trying to commit a crime or you're trying to prevent one. And being able to sort of take these very ordinary characters and ordinary people and throw them into these extraordinary situations, that's a lot of fun for me. It speaks to my sensibilities a little bit more than I used to take classes at Upright Citizens Brigade. I used to take sketch and improv classes, and they always used to say it's easier to remember than invent. And that's kind of one of the reasons why I feel like I gravitate towards crime a lot, is because not because I'm remembering previous crimes that I've done, but is because I feel like it's easier to start with character first and then concept second. And I think sometimes when you're doing sort of the spectacle of sci-fi or fantasy, it's very easy to get caught up in sort of that spectacle and that world building. And for me, it's always about the characters. If I'm not in love with the characters, I can't go the marathon of writing a whole script on them. And moreover, if I'm not in love with the characters, I certainly can't expect readers to be. But yeah, there's a ton of genres that I really want to explore. And that's the thing I love most about comics, is unlike Hollywood, for example, where, you know, everybody wants to put you in a box. It's a town full of storytellers that wants the quickest possible read possible, because, you know, everybody's getting flooded with scripts and, you know, those are not easy to read. Comics, on the other hand, I feel like there's a lot more room to kind of flex your muscles and try different genres and not necessarily get so pigeonholed, you know, into any one genre. I think my favorite story is Matthew Ehrman. You know, he wrote Long Lost with Lisa Sterl. And then, you know, his next project was co-writing a Care Bears book at IDW. I mean, usually the shifts are not quite that dramatic, but you know, there's something a little egalitarian about the comics industry, where you're not always locked into a specific genre. And if you've got the right story and you've got the right concept and you've got the right characters and you've got the right execution, publishers are more likely to let you take a chance and try telling different types of stories. And, you know, for me, I tend to get restless pretty easily. So being able to kind of keep flexing my muscles in different directions, that's part of the reason why I love comics so much.
Listeners might not know, you're a comic book reviewer at Newsarama.com, right?
Yeah, I am.
Would you say that's a viable path to write comic book reviews to, if you have an interest in writing comics, to start there?
Well, so I'm going to say yes or yes and no, because I think there are a lot of people who would make that misconception of thinking, oh, well, you know, he started writing reviews with the goal of writing comics. And actually, I kind of tripped and fell into the comics writing thing, believe it or not. I got my start in the industry interning at DC Comics. I worked in their editorial department. I worked on Batman RIP, Final Crisis, Green Lantern, Secret Origin. And at the time when I finished, I thought I wanted to be an editor. And the problem is that was during the recession. There were no editorial jobs at all, let alone at DC, let alone in comics. And so Newsarama was kind of my lifeline to stay in the industry. I had met Janelle Azelin, who was then an assistant editor in the Batman office, and she had gotten her start at Newsarama. And so I connected with Troy Brownfield, who was the reviews editor back then, and he kind of became my mentor, and I wound up sort of taking his place when he rode off into the sunset. So for me, what I would say, why I'm saying yes and no, is I will say writing reviews was the best possible training for writing comics, absolutely, because being able to sort of analyze a comic and figure out what you like and what you don't like and what does the and compare that to what the market might like, and being able to articulate why you do or do not like something, that's huge. For example, you know, I am not necessarily a huge fan of decompressed storytelling. I think it has to be used really judiciously. I think there are a lot of creators who use it kind of willy-nilly, and it makes each individual issue not a satisfying chunk, as Heidi McDonald would call it. So I learned pretty quickly I didn't like decompression. So that was something that I was trying to avoid, even with going to the chapel, where we don't necessarily get a ton of forward plot movement for our first issue. We get to introduce 16 speaking roles in the span of one issue, and I think we justify every character on the page. You know, or for example, you know, if you like, I'm a huge fan of a classic Frank Miller. I love the way that he plays with pacing and structure on the page. And so by being able to articulate that, by saying, for example, in Dark Knight Returns, you've got multiple panels of Martha Wayne's pearls, you know, breaking against Joe Chill's gun. And it's sort of that slow motion effect kind of draws out the tension for readers. And you sort of start to feel Bruce's anguish because you're forced to linger on these images. Being able to articulate that sort of stuff is a huge thing for being a writer.
Do you ever have to articulate to a comic writer that you might have written a negative review about in the back room at a convention that you didn't really like mean to hurt their feel? You know what I mean?
I've certainly had on occasion creators reach out to me and say like not be happy with a review, and I, you know, my answer is always the same, which is, any review that I write, I always try to remember that there's a human being on the other end of that review. And I think that's something that's been super important on both sides of the table for me. But also, you know, I tell them, like, I recognize how hard it is to make a comic. And I, you know, just like you have put in your all to do a comic, I'm going to do my best to sort of give you an even-handed, you know, analysis and sort of actually sort of stir up some conversation about your execution. And sometimes, you know, sometimes the book is great. Other times, you know, maybe the execution isn't quite there this time. But my thought is, you know, I always respect the work that somebody puts in, even if it's not to my tastes. And so I always try to write the reviews with that in mind, as sort of, I'm trying to analyze execution rather than a creator's personal, you know,
You have to review the work, not your preconception is or anything like that.
Yeah, and it's something that I think it's a lot of new reviewers, especially. I think that's a hurdle for them. I think it's so much easier to be snarky than it is to be sincere.
Mm-hmm. It's fun to be snarky too.
Yeah, and the thing is, yeah, and it's fun, and it gets you more clicks and retweets and all that.
Right.
And my thought is, you know, I there are a lot of reviewers who, you know, I think most reviewers do it for love of the game. And I think, you know, that's because it's comics reviews, man. Like, nobody's making a living off this. But there are, I think, some people who are fueled, I think, a little bit more by bitterness, or fueled by, you know, they have a preconception of what good comics look like and are sort of mad that the market hasn't, you know, has veered away from that. And, you know, I mean, look, everybody's got their own way of doing things. And so I can't knock anybody for it. But I know for me, and the thing that I've always tried to impress upon reviewers that I've worked with is, you know, think about this. If a critic or if a creator would want to punch you in the face if you said this to their face, maybe you should reconsider. Like, maybe there's another way you can write this. And it's not to say, I mean, look, you know, I've seen creators act badly about bad reviews, and I'm kind of like, dude, you're writing, you know, you're writing Spider-Man or whatever. You got to take your lumps, man. Like, that's just how it is. I've certainly, you know, we haven't gotten a ton of bad reviews, but I've had reviews where, you know, I'm just like, okay, take a deep breath. I am my friends and be like, wow, what an idiot. But I'm not saying anything in public. Like, why would I? You know, if you roll around with the pigs, you know, you're the one who's getting dirty and the pig is going to love it. So I feel like it's a tough road to navigate. I mean, for me, you know, my reviews, it is a freelance position. And so, you know, it gives me some structure to my day. But even for me, you know, it's an ongoing kind of dance in between the raindrops, because I always want to make sure that I'm avoiding a conflict of interest. And so, you know,
The more work you do in the industry, the more people you'll be working with. So you have to like, oh, can never write a review about a book, you know, drawn by Gavin, for instance.
Right. Exactly. Or, you know, I would never do a review on an Action Lab book for that exact reason.
True.
And, you know, or, you know, I've got a book that's due out with Top Cow. And so I have not been touching any Top Cow books for that exact reason. And, you know, I mean, I think it's an imperfect system? Of course. You know, I think as long as comics journalism is a tough road for people to make a full-time living at, it's always going to be sort of that element of sort of, you know, spit shine and duct tape. But I think to answer your initial question, do I think writing reviews is a good way to position yourself into writing comics? Absolutely not. No way. A lot of people will look at you as just a reviewer, and so you have to work twice as hard to prove that you can actually do the work as opposed to critiquing the work. But I think writing reviews, conversely, is the best training for writing comics.
So write the reviews, but just don't post them online.
Yeah, exactly. I will say, I remember, you know, one other, it's Scott Snyder. I did an interview with him once, and he said that one of the things he did for training was he would reverse engineer his favorite scripts. So he would take Batman Year One, for example, and he would just script based on what he saw on the page. And so I think writing reviews is a similar principle in a way. You're absorbing the content, and then you're kind of synthesizing, you know, for me, I always sort of figure out what's my gut instinct to all this. How do I, you know, if I read this book, just gut level, did I like it? And if the answer is yes, then I'm kind of like, all right, let's examine that feeling. Why do you feel that way? I guess it's like me being in a therapist's office. Whereas if I don't like it, I'm like, all right, well, let's explore that feeling a little bit more. Like, what didn't you like about it? And for me, doing that for 10 years, you know, I was able to really kind of quickly be able to rattle off, here's things I like about when comics creators do this. Here's things I hate when comics creators do this. And sort of being able to take creators I liked and turn them a little bit more into influences. You know, I still think I'm learning a ton. I think anybody who tells you that like they know exactly what they're doing is either lying to you or themselves. So for me, I kind of feel like I'm in this position now where it used to be, you know, what concepts did I want to play with? And now I'm starting to get into, oh, this is a storytelling technique that's really cool. Like, how can I incorporate that into something?
Right.
You know, I look at Jonathan Hickman's work on House of X right now, with the many lives of Moira X, and I'm kind of like, oh, that's a cool trick. time travel via reincarnation and parallel universes via reincarnation. Like, that's a cool idea. Like, I wonder if, you know, I wonder how I could incorporate something like that into the story, or something like immortality or something like that. And so I feel like, you know, reviewing comics, it's an ongoing education. And I think that's part of the reason why I've been able to pull off even the books that I've already written.
How many more issues of Going to the Chapel will there be?
Yeah, it's a 4-issue miniseries, so there's 3 more coming. And for me, I've found that, you know, crime especially, it lends itself well to 4- and 5-issue arcs, because you don't have to explain the world around you. Whereas, you know, Astro, for example, that is a longer script. And my fantasy script, that's a longer series, because you have to spend time just exploring the world around you.
Going to the Chapel number 1's out now. Issue number 2's out October 23rd.
Yes, and you can still pre-order it. You can pre-order our 3 covers with the code AUG for August, 1914-82 for Sweeney Boo's cover, 83 for Mon House's cover, and 84 for Gavin's cover.
Nice.
You can also pre-order issue 3 as well with the codes SEP for September, 1913-67 for Emily Pearson's cover, 68 for Mon House's cover, and 69 for Gavin Guidry's cover.
Is it 69 for a reason, or?
Nice. No, you know, that's just what Diamond said. And so I was just like, nice.
Well, issue 3 is out November 6th. Thank you so much for talking to us. Now, in our next segment, Super Fight, we take 2 superheroes, one from DC, one from Marvel, and we have them fight. But oh no, it's not a regular fight, because we're using the Super Fight Skybound card deck, which basically offers up ridiculous scenarios.
Yes, I'm excited.
So I'm going to generate a Marvel character, and okay. It is Rocket Raccoon.
Okay.
And I'm going to generate a DC character, Cyborg.
Okay.
Okay, who would be better at jousting? Go.
Oh, it'd have to be Rocket, because Rocket would steal Cyborg's arm.
Or his eye.
Or his eye, yeah.
Yeah,
or...
no.
They're both builders, though, right? Like, they can cook something up really fast.
I think Rocket's more agile. I think straight on jousting, I think Vic would have a harder time getting a beat on Rocket. Plus, Rocket cheats. That's the thing.
That's true.
Rocket cheats, and so I'm giving the raccoon. I think I'm giving him the handicap on this one.
I would agree with that, unless there's horses, because it might be hard for Rocket to ride a horse, right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I feel like I would imagine that they would be jousting with jetpacks, and so we can only hope. We can only hope. The only way that I see Vic pulling this off is if Vic knows how much of a cheat Rocket is, and so he cheats back and he throws Rocket into a boom tube before Rocket can actually hit him.
Oh shoot, yeah. He could just throw up the boom tube and then just throw a stick through it, right? I mean, well, like the jousting thing. What do you call that?
Yeah. Yeah, well, a lance. Well, lance. They're coming right at each other, and then Vic just opens up the boom tube and Rocket just finds himself in Apocalypse somewhere. I could see that definitely happening, but I think Vic is the kind of guy, you know, he was an athlete, so he believes in rules. Rocket does not believe in rules. So I think Rocket is going to hand the Tin Man his ass.
JJ, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's just no contest there. Every one of Vic's body parts is going to be a target for Rocket and his collection of weird things.
Yeah.
All right, I think I agree with you guys too. Rocket's definitely going to win that. So, in our last segment, Off Topic Top Shelf, we're going to give you the floor, David. Yeah. What is something that you're really into right now that's not comics related, and why?
Oh, man, I've been binging really hard on Mindhunter lately. And boy, I love that series. First off, big David Fincher fan,
and a big crime fan.
I love the way that Fincher just like brings mood into the mix, and his editing style on his projects is always really cool. But it's about how the FBI started thinking about psychological profiling for serial killers in the late 60s and 70s, and it's really cool. I love this sort of idea of a a FBI analyst who he's starting to get a little too close to his subjects. You know, it's sort of that phrase, the abyss gazes also. And so seeing this kind of ordinary guy who is determined to figure out what breeds serial killers, you know, starting to kind of have his own psychological stability start to erode a little bit. And that the effect kind of, you know, ripples across his partners as well. Like his one of his partners, his son is basically nonverbal. And we start to learn that there's some more sort of sinister stuff going on with this guy's kid. It's a really cool series. There's two seasons of it right now on Netflix. I'm digging that a ton. And yeah, I always try to watch things that I use sort of as research, a little bit of research and a little bit of entertainment. And Mindhunter is for sure that's hitting that sweet spot for me right now.
Yeah, I really dug the first season. I've been digging into the second slowly, but it's definitely very well done.
Yeah, it's a super fun thing. And just watching, you know, it's fictionalized for sure, but it is set during real world history. And so you start seeing things like Charles Manson and Ed Kemper and some very kind of creepy killers who have done some very horrific things, and sort of trying to get into that. Oh, it's unsettling, to say the least.
Well, David, we're at the end of the show. Thank you so much for being on. If you're listening, please subscribe, please like, please review the show. And JJ, thank you for being my co-host.
Yeah, it was a blast. David, it was a good being a first timer with you.
Absolutely. No, thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And go check out Going to the Chapel, which is out now.
Yes, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Go to the Chapel. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at PepOSD. And you can also sign up for my new newsletter, Pep Talks, at bit.ly/pepnews.
Pep News. Get there now. Go, go, go.